A high-profile trial ends in an acquittal. A mother speaks out after a deadly police shooting. And an unexpected challenge for Wisconsin tourism. It's all coming up on Reporter's Notebook. I'm Adam Roberts.
News doesn't start with the headline. It starts with the reporter.
She said the words, "I won't forget it. What more do you want from me?"
When your public records request is fulfilled, it feels like you're waking up to a Christmas gift in your inbox.
It was on the fly decision-making. It was drinking water from a fire hose at that point.
Bringing you the story behind the story. This is Reporter's Notebook. Now here's your host, Adam Roberts.
Welcome to Reporter's Notebook, where we analyze news from the perspective of the reporter and dive deeper on stories that deserve a closer inspection. I'm Adam Roberts. Thanks once again for joining me on the show this weekend. You know, I was doing some math and thinking in my head that there was something significant about this particular week of Reporter's Notebook, and it occurred to me that we have now been back on WTMJ doing Reporter's Notebook for exactly 1 year this weekend. So small milestones, but something notable to mention. Glad, of course, every week to be with you on the show and hoping for many, many more episodes to come. But as we always say, the news doesn't stop, and we've got another great show coming up for you today. On the program, we'll be joined by WTMJ's new community reporter, Tori Lowe. You've likely heard Tori's voice on several reports this last month or so in his new position here in the WTMJ Breaking News Center. But you might be wondering, well, what does a community reporter mean? What does that role mean, and what is Tori going to be doing for the station? We'll explain when Tori joins the program today. And also, as the month of June continues and the weather stays warm, thousands of Wisconsinites and people from outside of the state, too, are flocking to some of our state's big tourism boom towns. Think Door County up in northeast Wisconsin. Maybe the Wisconsin Dells for a family trip to a resort or water park. Maybe it's going all the way up to the Apostle Islands National Lakeshore in the northern part of our state. There are sections of our state that rely heavily on the dollars, millions of them, that come in this time of year. But underneath it all, those tourism sectors are held up by the work of many people out of the nation coming into the U.S. and working on foreign H-2B visas. And this summer, several Wisconsin businesses in key tourism areas are dealing with a massive backlog in processing these visa applications. And it got me thinking to a story I reported on in 2024 relating to a shortage of foreign-born priests within the Archdiocese of Milwaukee due to a similar backlog and a wait period for their visa applications. I'll have an update on that story and speak with a front-of-house manager for a well-known Wisconsin restaurant in Door County dealing firsthand with these issues. That's coming up later on in the show. But when we come back, we're going to break down maybe the biggest story in news of this past week here in southeast Wisconsin, that being the trial of Amandria Brunner, a woman from West Allis accused of causing a crash that ended in the deaths of Marquette lacrosse athletes Scott Michaud and Noah Snyder last September near 27th and St. Paul. The trial, ending this past Thursday, led to a complete acquittal for Brunner by way of a not guilty verdict on all six charges she faced from a jury at the Milwaukee County Courthouse. WTMJ's Elizabeth Lintonen was at the courthouse for the proceedings, and she breaks down what happened, why it did, and what happens next when we return on Reporter's Notebook. A major trial in Milwaukee County this week, drawing a lot of attention and setting up potential interest for a second trial later this year, possibly. We're referring to the case of Amandria Brunner, the woman from West Allis, who this week was accused and seated for a jury trial in the deaths of two Marquette lacrosse athletes at 27th and St. Paul in a car crash last September. The athletes, Scott Michaud and Noah Snyder, two of six passengers total in a Jeep,
moving south towards the 27th Street Viaduct when the crash happened involving Brunner and the driver of the Jeep, Peter McColgan. More on that second name in a moment. First, the jury trial for Amandria, happening this week, began on Monday with jury selection and was wrapped up by Thursday with a complete acquittal for Brunner on all charges.
For everyone present, the verdicts are not guilty on all six counts. As to count one, we the jury. All right, leave. Nope, time to go. Anyone in the gallery, I said you need to leave. If you can't contain yourself, leave now.
Judge David Swanson reading the verdict there, and you can hear some emotion in the gallery that resulted in a quick pause in the read. People had to be asked to leave, but ultimately, the verdict was a pretty short ordeal in general. The judge reading the verdict, and within a few minutes, it was all said and done. But now what comes next? WTMJ's Elizabeth Lintonen was in court this week for the trial and joins us here on Reporter's Notebook. Liz, welcome back.
Thank you, Adam.
So let's break it down and let's start with, I'm most interested as someone like yourself who was in the room pretty much the entirety of the trial, I believe Monday with jury selection. Sometimes you kind of just know what's going to be happening there. But you were there much of Tuesday, all on Wednesday, and then for the all-important verdict on Thursday. Give me a sense for the level of tension in the room, like compared to a case like, say, the Sade Robinson trial, like, say, compared to the Maxwell Anderson trial, which you covered for us also late last year. Maybe compare and contrast tension levels.
It's interesting. So with the Maxwell Anderson trial, there was a very clear sense of, you know, right and wrong. You know, Maxwell Anderson, there was an insurmountable amount of evidence against him. And so being in that courtroom was very different than this one because there was not a lot of Anderson's family there. There was a lot of Sade Robinson's family there. And you kind of knew what you wanted to happen. You know, you wanted the prosecution to win. You wanted him to get life in prison for that heinous, heinous crime. I mean, that's kind of what you were, not someone to root for, because that's obviously not how we approach court cases. But, you know, there was a clear sense of like right and wrong and what's about to happen. Mm-hmm. With this one, it was very tense. It was palpable tension at every moment because Amandria Brunner, while driving drunk and high, you know, it wasn't like she intentionally killed somebody, you know, and it wasn't even like she obviously killed somebody. She tried to turn left through a yellow light. So it was a very, very different experience because on both sides of the courtroom, you know, there were families that were at risk of losing their loved ones, you know, with the two boys who unfortunately passed away in this crash and then Amandria Brunner's family herself, there was a lot of people in support of her on that side of the courtroom. There was a lot of tears. The other thing is you have to remember that the victims' families, you know, Noah Snyder and Scott Micho's families, who were those two lacrosse players that were killed, they were sitting in the right side of the courtroom having to watch the video of the crash that killed mm-hmm. their sons over and over and over and over again,
right.
You know, to analyze that evidence. So it was a little more sad, I would say, and then it was pretty nuanced, but very, very tense from both sides of the courtroom.
One of the interesting things I noted as this trial began, so Amandria Brunner faced in total six charges. There was an amended mm-hmm. Her charges were amended as the trial began to get to those total of six. It was interesting that at no point has Brunner been charged with operating while intoxicated or driving under the influence.
Well, and that, I think, honestly, is the prosecution's biggest mistake in this case, is that they put forward charges that were too serious for what she did. You know, she did drive while intoxicated, and they could have got her on a lesser charge, like even a manslaughter charge. I think they would have had a much better case for that. But when we're talking about homicide, which is what she was charged with, it was negligent vehicular homicide. Homicide is super severe. You know, it entails a lot of nuance. It has to entail that she was the direct cause of a death. And while she did, you know, obviously, no one is arguing that she made a very, very severe detrimental mistake, but it's really hard to argue that she was the only cause of this crash, and B, like the direct cause of this crash.
So I'm going to play this clip here from prosecuting attorney Emily Zimmel, who was leading the case for the state. I thought, well, just listening to her tone of speech and how she delivered her remarks, she was very passionate and mm-hmm. convicted in her belief, which is understandable. I'm going to play this clip here that was a part of closing statements. Emily indicating through a personal story why she believed that both sides of this, both drivers, could be held at fault.
Two bad drivers contributing to the death of two people does not mean that everyone just gets to wash their hands and be like, all right, well, they both did bad things, so I guess no one gets punished. It means both of them get to be held accountable for their actions in this case.
But, Liz, as we would see, the jury, as I mentioned, found Brunner not guilty on all charges. So how do you, in your view, did they come to their decision?
I think it was a couple of things. I think one of the questions they asked immediately after deliberation started, which was like 3 p.m. Wednesday, they, you know, every time they have a question, court has to like go back in session and it has to be answered with the attorneys in front of everybody. And one of the questions they had asked were, there were two questions that stood out to me right away that they asked. And one of them was whether or not they could consider the driving of Peter McColgan, who was he's a Marquette University lacrosse athlete who was driving the vehicle. And then the other thing they asked, which I thought was rather significant, was they asked, there were six people in a car that sat five, mm-hmm. and they asked if they could consider that as well. So I think what ultimately happened is that they believe that Peter McColgan was more at fault than Amandria Brunner, if I had to take a very educated guess at it. Again, I think another problem with the prosecution was that these charges were just too severe. I just don't think it was a homicide situation. But at the end of the day, if the evidence showed in the black box data, which is just a computer that is in like your car that tells you in the like last 5 seconds leading up to impact, it tells you how fast you were going, how far the accelerator was pushed down when you were driving, like, you know, things like that. Amandria Brunner, when she was driving, was going at most 15 miles per hour, and she was technically over the stop line during the yellow light. So it's not like she ran a red turning left. Mm-hmm. She could have just stopped and not made the left turn, and I think that's what the prosecution's like big point was that she just, it would have been made a lot more sense for her to just not go, which I agree with. But at the same time, Peter McColgan was driving, he was trying to beat the yellow light coming straight on, and he was going 56 miles per hour with the accelerator pushed down 100% in a 30 mile per hour zone. So when Brunner turned left, she clipped it, and then they spun and hit a pole. It's that second impact also, according to black box data, that was more severe. So at the end of the day, I think the charge of homicide was just too severe, because while she was a major factor, no one is arguing that she was a major factor in causing the crash and the death of those two boys, but I don't think she was the only factor.
And so now, bringing it back to McColgan, the second driver in all of this, he is set to make his initial appearance on separate charges in this crash in July. Mm-hmm. So it's very likely he will have his own jury trial at some point, either late this year or, given how slow court can move sometimes, maybe early next year. But I'm curious, and you may have the answer to this, maybe you don't, but how much his defense attorney and the jury in that possible trial may infer from the results of this case when they ultimately have to make a decision there.
And I think that's tough, because obviously the jury in that trial is walking around on Earth right now, does not know they're about to be a jury in this mm-hmm. trial. I mean, that's the thing. It's randomly pulled people from the public. So they're definitely, in this case, is all over local media. I believe it's gotten some traction from national media. So there's really no way for them to avoid media coverage, because they don't know they're the jury, so they can't be told ahead of time, like, don't consume anything related to Amandria Brunner. I think that the defense in that case will have a much harder task, because Brunner went first, and that jury ultimately, you know, decided that she was not guilty, that she is not the main perpetrator of this crash. So I think that they're going to have a very, very difficult task ahead of them in trying to prove his innocence, because if he also is found not guilty, then there's no one is found guilty in the crash that killed these two players, and we chalk it up to, you know what I mean? So I think it's just, I think it's going to be tough, because obviously, and I feel so bad for these victims' families, because obviously you want someone to be held, you're grieving, you want someone to be held accountable for something like this. And at the end of the day, now the likelihood is that it will not be the drunk driver, it will be one of their peers, one of their friends, someone they knew, you know? So I just think they're going to have a really tough time with that one.
WTMJ's Elizabeth Linton, and thanks so much.
Anytime, Adam.
Thank you.
If you've been listening to 620 at any point for the last roughly month or so, you may have been hearing a familiar voice, but in an added capacity, on the station these last 4 weeks or so. I'm joined today by WTMJ's new community reporter, Tori Lowe, who you might remember from the Tori Lowe Show on 101.7 The Truth. Tori, welcome in.
Hey, thank you for having me.
Yeah, we've had some interesting conversations that we'll touch on in a little bit as it relates to news, but you are now officially in the newsroom capacity in this new role, which we'll get to also in a moment. But for people who have heard your voice on WTMJ talking about stories in the community before, but maybe aren't so familiar with your background,
right.
I always love when I have people on to just give that little snippet of a story. How did you get to where you are? And I'd love to hear, especially even before you had your own show on 101.7 The Truth, what were you doing before that?
Well, I was an advocate in the community. I started by doing cleanups. That's one thing.
Community cleanup.
And like I said, I was always dealing with the community. And when people would come to me, they would come to me for issues after I would help them clean up their neighborhoods. And then next thing you know, they would circle around and say, hey, Tori, I have this problem, or there's a missing girl, or my son was killed due to senseless violence. And I was just at first I was like, OK, I'm wondering why they're coming to me. But then I just accepted it. And then I started looking into homicides, missing girls, some of the tougher issues in the community. And I was able to bring some results. I was able to figure some of these things out and get some of these families some resolve. And then I would put that on my social media, on my Facebook. And at the time, I have a degree in broadcasting. So at the time, all I did was just use my skills from working at CBS 58, NBC3 in Madison. And I just started when I was in high school, I had my own TV show called Teen Talk, Teen Video Project at MATA, at the public access channel. So,
sure.
So I used all those skills to help people in the community. And once I started understanding that social media gave us audio, pictures, and sometimes video, that's a news station to me. So I was like, okay, I got something to where I can actually put out what's going on in the neighborhoods and what I was actually dealing with. And I built a huge following over the years. I got a huge following, 80,000 followers on Facebook. I didn't really use TikTok or anything like that. As a matter of fact, TikTok wasn't even TikTok at the time. And Instagram was fairly new, and it was more about fashion and things like that. But Facebook and Twitter were kind of things where I was using to kind of get the community concerns across. So as I built that up, people started coming to me. Even news channels started coming and grabbing my stories. Even the Journal started calling me, getting my stories off of what I was posting online. And then reporters would come and tell me, hey, Tori, don't post anything unless you talk to me first, because they wanted to get the story. So I was like,
course.
You know, and salute to Jamont, a lot of these reporters that would come from different stations. Then all of a sudden news stations started assigning reporters to my page. And so then all of a sudden I'm in the middle of all of this commotion with the community. But all I was doing was really getting in the front rooms, handling situations that wouldn't make the news. And that's how it started.
So now you're in this new role that we've built for you here as a community reporter. And one of the things that I've been monitoring as you've started this new role is finding the balance between, as you mentioned, you have people coming up to you all the time saying, mm-hmm. hey, I've got a problem, or hey, this isn't being talked about. Classic expression.
Right.
No one's talking about this. Mm-hmm. And then in your prior roles, you would shine light, as we like to say, on those issues. Now in your new role, that's still very much a part of what you're doing. But what we saw with the Dan Jansen Festival story that you did, you are still going and doing that both sides reporting, that all sides reporting,
right.
that is a very important facet of what we do. Have you felt, as you've developed this role, that push and pull of your past work advocating for people with issues while also now dealing with broadcast and journalism integrity?
Well, in reporting, it's a whole different ballgame. You got to tell all the sides. And what I try to do is make sure that I tell all the sides fair and balanced. And that's what reporting is to me. And if you're not going to do it that way, then you shouldn't be a reporter. Maybe you should be a radio show host or something. Hmm. Maybe you should be something else. Or just stick with social media. So in my eyes, I was taught that reporting is fair and balanced. So you try to call each side, try to give them an avenue to express how they feel about the situation. Then you let the audience read a fair and balanced situation and then come up with the conclusion. And I think that that's my style of reporting. I want to make sure that sometimes I reach out to agencies and they don't want to answer. So, but you give them the opportunity to speak. And I think that many times when you talk about reporting, especially in 2026, where there's so many leading reports or people trying to make people think a certain way, I'm always independent. I always think that you should always make sure that everybody have a say or a voice in what makes the article great is that the reader can walk away from that article and say, I can see both sides, but this is how I feel about them.
And that'll be interesting because of your background in community advocacy. I think there may be, just speaking candidly, some of those questions right away. But I know you are going to be someone who will give that other side a chance to respond, like the Dan Jansen story.
Right.
Very easily could have been, oh, this awful thing happened, mm-hmm. but we need to paint a full picture of the situation.
Well, it was a teachable moment. It mm-hmm. was a teachable moment. Some people don't even know there's policies due to private festivals. And with all the takeovers going on, with all of the things that are going on with the youth, the hoodie, a lot of these young people are wearing those hoodies. And a lot of these parents just want to go out, bring their kids to the festival. Well, I felt that this was a teachable moment that we can now, hey, look, this is a policy. And if your child has a hoodie on and they're asked for the hoodie to be taken off, just take the hoodie off and continue to have a great time.
What's a story, topic, or an area of news you believe, because you're now reaching a new audience mm-hmm. with our station,
yep.
what is an area you believe has been undercovered by not just us, but other typical news outlets in the past that you want to shine more light on?
Well, the thing is, what you want to show with your reporting is many times my perception coming from the north side of Milwaukee, a lot of those stories are not told. And even when I deal with situations in Green Bay or Antigo, Wisconsin, or Beloit, Wisconsin, I travel a lot. I go up and down the state. I was the most requested advocate in the state for a long time. Mm-hmm. So I get to see different ideas that, you know, I have brought attention to so many different cultures, so many different races during my journey. But a lot of my work stems from where I was born and raised on the north side of Milwaukee, Wisconsin. Probably, I would say, 80% of the people that come to me are from my area where I was born and raised. So the other 20% was spread across the state of Wisconsin, whether it was policy change, CIT, we was in Madison for that. I was on the state board for justice reform in the state of Wisconsin. Speaker Voss had that. I was on that board. So I get to see across Wisconsin. But at the same time, we got to talk about housing, economics. We got to talk about certain policies that are affecting mental health. We got to start focusing on lead poisoning. Are townships doing what they can to remedy a lot of the lead laterals in the city? You know, so we want to focus in on kind of what's the community concern? What is the community really concerned about in these areas?
Before I let you go, it's interesting you brought up housing because the mayor of Milwaukee, Cavalier Johnson, made his big year of blank for this year being the year of housing. Mm-hmm. And suddenly you've seen a lot of these stories around some of the disparities that we've seen in that and also some of the successes, to be fair. I don't know if anyone ever anticipated affordable housing being built in Whitefish Bay,
right.
but that has happened in the last year or so. So mm-hmm. it is interesting now. What you will be covering a lot of is some of these stories that suddenly are being talked about, but you know, hey, this has been an issue a lot longer than 2026.
I agree. And I have people that called me within the last couple of years because of Hackam, the Milwaukee Housing Authority. And mm-hmm. these are elders that's supposed to be relaxing in their latter years. And now they're afraid of what's going on. So we got to tell these stories because many times these are the stories that don't get truly covered from a personal standpoint, maybe from a political standpoint. Maybe we'll grab some people at the meeting. But I think it's time to get in these front rooms and really dive into the real concerns of community members and their neighborhood. And I think that when we start getting getting deeper instead of covering more surface level politics, what politicians say, things like that. I think it's time to get back to the front rooms. And this is where we start to really make a difference, when we really tap into the real concerns of community members all across the state of Wisconsin.
He's WTMJ community reporter Tory Lowe. Going to be hearing a lot more of him as the months and years go forward. Tory, thanks so much.
Hey, thank you, Adam, for having me.
Wrapping up this edition of Reporter's Notebook, looking back on a conversation I had this past week with a business in Door County up in northeast Wisconsin, as tourism season is reaching its apex, an apex it will likely be in for the next several months, as families and couples make their way not just up to Door County, but several other parts of Wisconsin that heavily rely on tourism during the summer. Think the Wisconsin Dells, maybe the Apostle Islands areas. But a lot of businesses that rely on the dollars this tourism brings are currently dealing with a backlog of visa applications for their summer foreign workers. These visas, known as H-2Bs, often apply to workers from countries in Eastern Europe or Central and South America who come up to Wisconsin from a portion of April till about the end of October to work in several of these businesses that need volume of employees to handle the volume of customers that they receive. There was a great piece written this past Monday in the Milwaukee Journal Sentinel by reporter Jehad Jang. I'll include a link to that story in our Reporter's Notebook website page on WTMJ.com. And as I was reading Jehad's piece, it got me thinking a bit about a business that I visited not all that long ago, about a month ago, just before Memorial Day with my wife, that if you've lived in Wisconsin for a long enough period of time, you're likely familiar with when it comes to Door County. Al Johnson's Swedish Restaurant and Boutique. If you know nothing about the name, if that name doesn't do anything for you, you've likely seen pictures of the restaurant's exterior, particularly its grass roof, on which goats are often seen eating and just hanging out. It's a very popular tourist attraction, drawing over 1,000 people a day during its peak in the summer. I spoke this week with Al's front of house manager, Jimmy Blossom Bexel, to check in on how the situation was progressing. And she told me that while they have some of those H-2B workers now, things were looking dire right as tourism season was about to begin.
A typical year, it would be, 19 or 20. This year, we have 6. And those are all cook visas. Our other visas, the other 11, I don't know if it's 11 or 12 H-2B visas, those were in a poorer category. They were in a lesser category, less desirable. That category only allowed us to hire other H-2B visa participants within the United States. And while that is wonderful, our H-2B people that we've been hiring the past couple years, we can hire the same employee for 3 years because you don't have to keep training them. You know, they come, they work 9 months, they go home. They come back, they work 9 months, then they go home. So it's saving, I mean, it costs you a lot, but at the same time, it's saving you money and training. But then when they changed the game on us for these other 11, 12 visas this year, and now we can only hire in the United States, while our other employees in those other countries don't get their visa this year. So they're sitting in other countries now, and they thought they were coming back. They're not. And now we don't have those employees. So now it's like, do we hire somebody, an H-2B person, from somewhere else? Like, do we find another agency? You know, it's all last minute. So it's like, what do you do? It put us in a real, real pinch. So then I just hired J-1 visa students because it just didn't work out. It was a big headache. It's complicated. I'll just put it that way.
Have you guys had, as a team, had difficult discussions about, do we need to, this summer, given the situation, alter hours, alter days we may be open? Explain.
Yes, we did talk about, at one point, if these H-2B, if we didn't get these, at least these six H-2B visas, if it would have taken any longer for them to arrive, we would have had to close down a day. We discussed closing down a day a week until they did arrive, because the kitchen, you just can't have people literally making pancakes and prep cooking at the same time. I mean, only because the volume we go through is so huge.
That again, Al Johnson, Swedish restaurant and boutique front of house manager, Jamie Blossom Bexel. And you know, while I was talking about all of these H-2B visa situations, it got me thinking back to a story I reported on about 2 years ago, similar but different, related to another visa situation involving foreign-born clergy members in the Archdiocese of Milwaukee. You may recall this from late 2024. These foreign-born priests who were on temporary R1 visas, which last up to 5 years, had to apply for permanent residency as part of the process, and there was a massive EB4 green card category buildup and backlog that was happening. And so there was a real threat for around 24 of these international priests within the Milwaukee Archdiocese to be either deported or forced to depart the country through the U.S. State Department. Well, the update on that is that there have been some policy moves that have made it easier for foreign-born priests and religious workers to apply for re-entry into the country immediately rather than being required to wait a year. There have also been some pushbacks on general immigration that we have seen under the Trump administration. So as far as that situation goes, what I've been able to deduce is that largely there hasn't been a whole lot of an update. Now, there are currently, no, I've been able to learn through a source, no foreign-born priests within the archdiocese that are in danger of being deported or are stuck in limbo at this point. But it is still an issue that's not going away, and it's another reminder that many of the established facets of our everyday lives, whether it's our faith or where we go on vacation, would not exist and can't exist without the labor from individuals who work jobs that local residents can't or won't do. And both are, of course, stories that we will continue monitoring closely. That'll do it for Reporter's Notebook. My thanks to Elizabeth Lintonen and Tori Lowe for joining me on the show this week. I'm Adam Roberts. Thanks for listening, and we'll see you next time on Reporter's Notebook.